Athol Fugard's 1984 play, The Road to Mecca, is about an eccentric amateur artist who has turned her home and garden into a fantasy world populated by exotic creatures made of cement and glass. And it's about how the residents of the local town react to her creations. The play is just now being given its Broadway premiere by the Roundabout Theater at the American Airlines Theater on 42nd Street, just in time for Mr. Fugard's 80th birthday next year. And I'm very pleased to welcome two of its stars, Tony Winners, Rosemary Harris, and Jim Dale, back to our show. Hello.
Hello.
Rosemary, this play was first performed in New York at Lincoln Center in 1987. Why do you think it's taken so long for it to be given a Broadway production?
I can't imagine. It's such a beautiful play. Actually, I was... Todd did ask me to do it about 10 years ago. But the timing wasn't right, and it didn't seem to be the right time to do it. And it's not often in life you get a second chance. And when the second chance came around, I grabbed it.
Isn't the character you play, Miss Helen, based on an actual person named Helen, Helen Martins?
Yes. Oh, yes, very much so.
How much did you know about her before you took the role?
I didn't know a lot. Of course, I knew she was real. But, of course, with the charm of internet, I just had to put her name into my Google, and up came all this wonderful information about her. So if anybody wants to find out more, they should Google her.
And Jim, you play Marius Bielefeld, the minister in the small town of New Bethesda in the Karoo region of South Africa where Helen lives. Mm-hmm. Is he based on a real character? You must have spoken to the playwright about
this. I've spoken to Athol about it. He wrote this part for himself. And he appeared in the play, playing the role himself. I don't know whether there was an actual person involved with Helen at that particular time. The other lady in the show, yes, she did. Helen did have a friend, a younger lady. But I think Athol has put together the play based upon primarily the lady who the play is about, the outsider artist, this wonderful outsider artist that.
But there must have been many clergymen like Marius Bielefeld because he does kind of represent a certain attitude that we would expect from South Africa.
Absolutely, yes. He is a preacher, not was born in a very small town. He has preached in the larger towns and cities, as he admits. But then for the last 20 years, he's been in this small village, and of course he's found his love of life. He wanted to escape from life after the death of his wife, and now has found what he believes is the real world down there.
Had either of you acted in one of Athol's plays before?
No, unfortunately.
No, I hadn't. No. Always looked forward to it, but it's the first time.
Well, he was in New York recently. Was he involved in rehearsals?
Oh, yes, absolutely. Trying to instill in me the South African accent that he has. It was very, very broad. So broad, in fact, that I thought if I did it as broad as that, maybe you wouldn't understand it. So I reduced it. But it was a great help to listen to Athol and also the enthusiasm that he has for this play and the enthusiasm that he has of working with actors, because he himself is not just a playwright. He's also an actor, so he understands the problems that he knows we're going to be facing in the future and gives us some idea of how to get over them.
Well, this is kind of an anomaly for him because all of his other plays were about race. And race is here, I guess, but only as a subtext.
Yes, it's sort of on the periphery. It really is about an artist, and I think trust is a very major word, and trust in oneself and trust in one's vision and the people who support that vision.
But it's also about conformity, and when somebody breaks out of the traditional norms, that person then gets treated as an outsider and almost as a danger. And I suspect that he was saying something about how the other is always the danger in a society where racism is pretty much at the center of the way people live.
In any society, if you want to be different, then you face quite a few problems there. And so this happens in this particular play. a lady decides to leave the church. She becomes an outsider artist, much to the frustration of the local preacher. And he wants her back in the fold. There may have been some relationship in the way of he possibly being in love with her, but never having told her this. But he wants her back in the fold. And when one of his flock stray away, then he wants to do everything he possibly can to get her back. And this is a wonderful, the words are so wonderful that he's written to describe how this preacher goes about trying to do that.
Well, part of the fun for you must be in having the audience continually change its attitude about this character. First, they hate him. Then they think, well, maybe he may be right here. And it ends with something a lot more complicated.
Well, when Rosemary walks on the stage at the very beginning of the stage, I hear this wonderful applause over the tannoy system in the dressing room. When I walk on the stage, I expect them to start booing.
Because we've been prepared to hate him.
They've been told about this terrible man who's trying to put her into an old age home. So obviously they're on her side from the moment I walk on.
You didn't know you had a green light on you, did you?
I expected music to play like da-da-da-da when I made an entrance.
Your character, Rosemary, also goes through changes here. She's weak. She's strong.
Yes.
She's somebody we feel a little pity for, and then we admire her. All just In the script itself, or is this something you have to bring to it?
No. It's all there. It's all there for the
asking. I'm sorry. I contradict. You've brought so much to this.
No, not at all. No. And, you know, I'm at an age where a lot of my own personal friends are facing the same thing that Helen is, of perhaps having to move into a retirement home. So that's very poignant for me. I've got relatives, sisters-in-law and sisters, and facing that. And at the moment, I'm not facing it at all. I'm on the stage doing an Athol Fugard play, so it's quite different.
I understand that he wrote the role of Miss Helen with the South African actress Yvonne Briceland in mind, and then Actors Equity didn't want to allow her to perform the role here.
Oh, no, I can't believe that. I thought she did, though, didn't she?
Well, it got complicated, as I understand it. The play premiered at Yale Rep in 1984, but then didn't come to New York until 1987 because of all those casting issues.
I see. Goodness, I didn't realize that. Amy Irving was wonderful in it, and of course, Mr. Fugard himself and Yvonne. It was a beautiful production.
In the play, Miss Helen is a widow who has come to what we would call become an outsider artist, as you say. But that concept probably didn't even exist in 1974, did it? Mm-hmm. It might have just been called a naive or primitive.
An outsider, yes, I suppose.
We have them in America. There was a couple who, in the 40s, created unbelievable creatures. The man carved the flat two-dimensional shape of strange alien shapes or rabbits, and his wife collected old bottle tops and nailed them on every conceivable flat surface. And then
there's a Watchtower.
Have one of these figures at home. We found it in a field at an antique fair, and it's one of the collection of about 150. So this was being done in America as well as in South Africa.
Of course, in earlier years, she would have been burned as a witch.
Well, absolutely.
She was such
well,
an
there's
outsider.
Almost that threat in this case.
Well, it's the fear. In our play, they throw stones at her beautiful garden. In fact, when she lived there, she actually grew cacti around her home to stop the children from invading it and destroying it.
And now they have to put up fences for other reasons because it's become a tourist attraction.
Yes.
It's a very, very big tourist attraction in the way of a museum now of her wonderful art.
She spent 15 years building a garden filled with camels, lions, owls, and other animals made of cement and glass. And that was her vision of Mecca?
No, I think Mecca, there is to reach one's Mecca is also an expression, isn't it, from the Rubaiyat, to fulfill oneself. And I think maybe Athol was using that. I remember my mother talking in earlier years that she hadn't reached her Mecca yet because she hadn't fulfilled herself in a certain way. So the Mecca is not literal. but it is sort of your goal in life, I think.
And then, of course, her home itself. She decorated it with unbelievable paints and glass so that when she did light the candles at night, and there were many, many, many candles, the whole room...
Which become part of the plot.
Yes, exactly. Mm-hmm. The whole room glittered, bouncing light from one mirror to another, and the effect must have looked stunning in the original house itself.
But the result of all that ground glass, they were empty beer bottles she said she used to grind up with a coffee mill. I think the ground glass went into her eyes, and her eyesight became very, very poor. She couldn't see anymore, and her hands were filled with arthritis. And, of course, as we know, she did actually commit suicide. She didn't want to end like that.
He wrote the play after she'd committed suicide. I guess this is a kind of homage to her.
Yes, but he didn't want to put that into the play, which is quite right, I think.
The set, do we know if the set is based on her actual house with the Mona Lisa in the background? She has a print of the Mona Lisa on the wall.
That's in her house, definitely.
That's right. As Rosemary said, if you go onto YouTube, you can dial in and actually see a video of a man with his camera wandering through the house, zooming in on the very pictures that she has and on all the intricate things that she did to it, as well as wandering through the garden and seeing these outrageous figures with whole Victorian skirts made of bottles.
And mermaids.
And mermaids.
And owls. She was very particularly fond of owls.
My guests are Rosemary Harris and Jim Dale, two of the three members of the cast of The Road to Mecca, the third one being Carla Gugino.
Who is just absolutely sublime in the play. She's just wonderful.
Now, the point is made in the playbill that two of these characters are Afrikaners and the third is British.
Yes.
And that is important for someone to know if they know a bit about South African history?
Well, I didn't realize she was British. I knew she came from Cape Town. She came from the big city.
But there's the British group, whether you were born in England
or not. Oh, I see, yes, but rather than Afrikaan, yes.
Yeah, there are these two separate groups that were to some degree at loggerheads, although apartheid was a kind of de facto way of life when the British were ruling the country. It only became law when the Afrikaners took over after World War II.
We've never explained that this particular play takes place in 1974, I believe. So that was a few years ago, and in those days things were a little different, as you know.
Well, and one of the things that makes Miss Helen a bit of an oddity is she calls a teenage black girl her best friend.
Yes, yes.
Another thing that annoys the locals.
Her only friend. Yes. She's been ostracized by everybody else.
Now, you want to talk a bit about the Elsa character? You say that she's based on a real person as well.
I think, I'm not sure that, yes, I think Miss Helen did have a friend, and they became very close. And I think Mr. Fugard would say he couldn't find exactly, he knew the play was in his head somewhere, but he hadn't got a hook to hang it on. And somebody showed him a picture of Miss Helen with this young woman. And he said, aha, it was a aha moment. And he said, I've got my play. And, of course, that is Carla's part. And she's just wonderful. And I feel very privileged because I'm in the middle of the play and they both love me. What more could you
We're
ask?
We're fighting over her. Yeah.
In different ways.
Yes, in different ways.
The play deals also with the mysterious nature of creativity and the fear that it'll disappear. This is something that worries Helen. And I was wondering whether it was something that Ethel was dealing with at the time that he wrote the play, because writers do go through periods where they have to deal with writer's block. He didn't talk about that with you, did
we? Haven't spoken to him about that, no.
He also had just stopped drinking at the point that he wrote this play. And I don't know whether he felt that the drinking helped, or stopping drinking or drinking helped him write. These are the mysterious things that artists go through.
That's right.
I'm sure actors go through them as well. Is there a moment when you're creating a character like Helen where some little things click and you say,
but in the past about drinking, I'm not sure that it's as fashionable now as when I was a young actress, but I did work with Peter O'Toole and Richard Burton. And they didn't seem to be able to do it without drinking a lot. And then, of course, smoking. There's some writers that can't write unless they're smoking. I had a friend who was a journalist, and he said, "If I, you know, it'll kill me, but I can't write unless I'm got an ashtray filled with stubs."
Well, that's because people believe there's some kind of a magic involved in the creative process. He probably could have written quite well without the cigarette or the drink.
It does relax them as well.
Yeah. Frank Rich, in his review of the original Yale Rep production, called the play one of Fugard's most personal works. Do you think he'd agree with that statement?
I'm not sure. I don't know that.
I don't know. No.
Well, most of the most of his plays have dealt in the past with very overtly with race relations in South Africa, and this one doesn't. But do you think it addresses the issue of discrimination from a different angle? Is Helen shunned by the townspeople because she's seen to be dangerous, because she's become a nonconformist?
Yes, I think people are frightened of somebody who's different. And like in the old days, you know, if you were odd and peculiar, you know, you would have been deemed a witch and would have been ducked into the pond or something. And she became such a recluse. You know, her looks were... I've seen wonderful photographs of her, and she did look a little strange towards the end. And people, she avoided people. She would walk on the other side of the street. She didn't want people to see her. And as a young girl, she was really quite beautiful, or certainly attractive, but she looked very odd in her later years, sort of.
Well, you said she probably was going blind, and that is referred to in the play, and you hold your hands in a way that suggests arthritis or rheumatism.
And pain, yes, because, of course, in the burns that she got in the fire.
The play is in previews now?
Yes.
So
we're still rehearsing, in fact, after this.
We go straight back to the theater to polish off a few little moments, which is the wonderful part of it. We've explored it now, and now we're just focusing on... The first time we did it, it was just digging up that rough diamond, but you know from the writing that there is a beautiful stone inside there, and it just chip away, and hopefully in a couple of weeks' time it will be as polished as anything you could get from Tiffany's.
I've gotten the feeling from speaking with actors in the past that probably the best time to see a play is in the last week, because... it's before boredom has set in, but you have pretty much really figured out the character.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. I remember an actress on the last night of the play saying to the director, "I've got a wonderful moment, and if we do this play again, if we do it again." That was on the very last night of a long run.
But, of course, George Kaufman came back to see one of his plays. He'd been away from some time, and his telegram was, "Take out the improvements."
Have you done any research on this area, the Karoo region, where the play takes place?
Yes, we had photographs all over our rehearsal studio of the bleak...
We were lucky that our director actually has been there.
Oh, yes, of course.
Yes, of course. He stayed down. He stayed in the village where this happened. The author himself has a small house in that village. And, of course, that's where he said it's almost a dividing line down the center of Main Street. It's just a tiny village. But on one side you have what they call, all of them are called coloreds, and then the whites.
Now, Gordon Edelstein is the director.
Yes.
Ethel Fugard often directs his own productions as well.
Yes. He's doing one now at the moment, I believe.
Is he?
Ethel is directing a production here in New York in the next few weeks.
Well, yes, he will be. And, of course, Susan, our costume designer, it was lovely because it really was right from the source. She's been there, too. Mm-hmm. And she knows what people wore and how they looked, and that's been an enormous help.
This is Ethel Fugard's 80th year, and I gather that the Roundabout Theatre Company is going to be putting on a number of the plays in kind of a celebration of
The signature. I'm not sure it's the Roundabout.
Oh, it's the Signature Theatre, right.
The Signature, yes.
A full whole season of Ethel Fugard's work at the Signature Theatre.
Absolutely. Yeah.
Well, we've gotten them piecemeal in the past, but it probably would be very interesting. It would be like seeing a great Matisse show or suddenly getting to see how one play bounces off of another.
Absolutely.
Mm-hmm. So
I look forward to them all.
But you're not going to be in any others. How long is this run?
It goes till the second week in March, I think.
Mm-hmm. And then do you have other plans?
I'm just going to take a holiday. You see, don't forget, there's quite a few words in there. I have about 500 lines to memorize. Rosemary has at least 1,000.
Well, you come in at the very end of the first act, so you only have to dominate the second act.
And then Carla has, I think she has the most lines of all. Yes. So it's tremendous.
She's going straight into something
Yes,
else.
She goes into another play up in Long Wharf
Theatre. That Gordon's going to be directing her in. Yeah.
Same director.
Well, it still has to be easier for you than walking on a tightrope.
A 38-foot-long tightrope and singing a song at the same time. That was a lovely memory from Barnum all those years ago.
Well, I thank you both so much for coming by to talk about this show with us. My guests have been Tony Award winners, Rosemary Harris and Jim Dale, who are currently appearing in the Roundabout Theater's production of The Road to Mecca. It's at the American Airlines Theater on 42nd Street, and it's always a pleasure to see the two of you here and to see great actors continuing to work, because that's always the fear, isn't it, Rosemary?
Well, I suppose. Yes, it is. But I was just reading about Christopher Plummer in the New York Times this morning, and he said, what? There's no such word as retirement.
No, of course.
If there are no people keep on calling upon you to work.
But even if there are no words for the character, we can always play a corpse.
But who was it, another actor said, when you get older, the parts just get smaller. But in our case, that's not true.
They get bigger. This is wonderful.
This is one of the biggest parts I've ever played.
Thank you both so much for being with us.
Nice to be here. Thank you, too.